Hi guys, and welcome back to Tales from Wisteria Lane, the podcast where we give you a fair view of all things Desperate Housewives. I'm Joel.
I'm Billy Ray.
And today we are starting Season 6 with Season 6, Episode 1, Nice is Different Than Good.
How far we've come.
I know, from the very, very beginning.
We've done a lot of hours of podcasting.
We have, and we've watched a lot of hours of Desperate Housewives and loosely analysed them. So I will be doing the overview of the episode and B will be doing the trivia. So what do you have for Season 6, Episode 1's first lot of trivia?
Oh, I've got plenty.
Yeah.
So this episode was written by Mark Cherry and directed by Larry Shaw, and it first aired on the 27th of September 2009. So I also did a sort of what happened in the week kind of thing.
Yeah.
That you did last time, because I thought that was quite inspired. So on the 27th of September 2009, it was a Sunday, so it seems Desperate's continued with its Sunday slot for Season 6 as well. The number one song in the UK for that week was Break Your Heart by Tyo Cruz.
Okay.
Remember that?
I do remember that.
Throwback.
I'm only gonna break your heart.
And then the number one in the US was again the Black Eyed Peas, but this time with I Got a Feeling.
Oh, good God.
They were unstoppable.
Can we please let the Black Eyed Peas go?
So on Wednesday, the 23rd of September, 2009, Modern Family premiered on ABC.
Oh, my God.
And on Saturday, the 25th of September, 2009, Typhoon Ketsana hit the Philippines, China, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and Thailand, causing 700 fatalities.
Wow.
Horrible.
Yeah. Way to bring the mood up, babe.
Sorry. But those are pretty much the only things of note that I could find from that week. The title of the episode, Nice is Different Than Good, is a song from Into the Woods.
Yeah.
According to IMDb, Mark Cherry originally intended to marry Catherine and Mike, but decided to marry Mike and Susan after seeing fan reactions towards the possibility of the two of them reconciling.
Yeah.
Now, this episode also introduces Drea Di Matteo as Angie Bolan.
Neighbor of the season.
And I mispronounced her name, even though my trip. So she goes by the name Dre.
Yeah.
Which I've written in the trivia, and then I just pronounced it Drea. And was born on the 19th of January, 1972 in Queens, New York. And Dre is of Italian descent.
Yep.
She pursued a directing career at NYU's Tisch School of Arts, but acting caught her interest, and so she pursued that career instead. And you may recognize her from the TV show The Sopranos as Adriana, the Friends spin-off Joey, and the movie R Xmas. That title really throws me off.
Oh, okay.
She owned a rock and roll vintage clothing store in the East Village called Fifth Mart for several years, but she has closed it and considered reopening it in Los Angeles instead.
Oh, wow.
We've also got Jeffrey Nordling, who's introduced as Nick Bolan.
Yep.
He was born on the 11th of March, 1962 in Ridgewood, New Jersey, and apparently he is skilled in the art of stage combat and is a certified fight choreographer.
Cool.
So we may have some Mortal Kombat in this season.
Mortal Kombat.
He is known for Big Little Lies from 2017, 24 from 2001.
Yeah.
And Flight 93 in 2006. And he also graduated from the same college as Billy Graham and Wes Anderson.
Wow. Same year?
No, just the same college.
Oh, okay.
And then also, we are introduced to Beau Merchoff as Danny Bolan, the son.
Yeah, Beau Merchoff. Ooh.
So he was born on the 13th of January, 1989 in Seattle, Washington. 2 days later, his family moved to Victoria, British Columbia in Canada, which is on Vancouver Island. He started training as an actor at the age of 13 in Vancouver, British Columbia, which required him to take a 2-hour ferry boat ride and an hour bus ride into the city.
Oh, God.
Can't say he wasn't dedicated.
No, that's commitment.
He did this every week until moving to Los Angeles in 2009, where he began training at the Michael Wilson Studio.
Cool, okay.
So he kept that going.
Yeah.
He's also been in Awkward, where he played Matty, the main love interest, and won a Teen Choice Award for this in 2012. This is actually a show that I've been recently talking to you about.
Mm-hmm.
I watched that as a teenager and thought it was quite funny. However, I haven't watched it since, and I wonder if it's aged okay.
Most likely not.
So after that, he focused more on theatre and played Treat in a production of Orphans, Kent in Reasons to be Petty, and he's also been in movies such as Scary Movie 4, The Grudge 3, and I Am Number 4.
Okay.
And those are the neighbours of the season
that we are
introduced to.
Yeah.
And that is also all the trivia I have.
Fair enough. Okay. So let's get started. Previously on Desperate Housewives, Carlos and Gabby took in Carlos's niece, Anna. As Tom prepares to return to school, Lynette finds out that she's pregnant with twins. Orson is blackmailing Bree into staying married to him, but has no idea that Bree is cheating on him with Carl Meyer. And in the aftermath of the Dave drama, Susan and Mike kiss, and, you know, it's left on the cliffhanger as who does Mike marry in the end. Is it Susan or is it Catherine? And obviously Bea has already announced that it's Susan.
Yes, because of the trivia.
Yeah. So we meet Angie, Nick and Danny Bolin, and immediately are left wondering what secrets they're hiding, because neighbor of the season, they always have secrets.
Yeah, they don't always announce that they have secrets to hide straight away, but Angie's right up like, we have to come across as good and proper. We don't want them to know.
Yeah, I know. So Lee is the neighborhood realtor, and after being a little bit disrespectful about Edie, shows him around an available house on Wisteria Lane, which was Mary Alice's house.
That's exactly what I wrote.
What?
Lee's now an estate agent. Good for him getting something to do, although I hate the disrespect towards Edie's memory.
Yeah.
He's like, well, luckily for me, some old cow drove into a pole and got electrocuted or
right,
something.
Right, some dumbass drunk bitch drove into an electric power line and said the job opened up.
Like the disrespect.
I know, it's so rude. So none of them have any questions and are interested. Angie does seem to be a little bit of a force to be reckoned with, though, and she proper stands up to Lee so she can find out the house's secrets. And I must say, because of this scene, I do love Angie.
Oh, me too. Very intimidating, but right? So far,
she's straight like there, it. Like, what the hell's wrong with the house? Because if I find out something after I sign, then I will be going to your door because you live right across the road.
Yeah, this is a nice lesson. If something sounds like bullshit from a salesperson, maybe look into it.
Yeah, and also if you're a salesperson and you're lying, don't tell them where you live.
Yeah, that's not a good idea.
No, not at all. So Danny doesn't seem to be too fast. Danny's the son, and he doesn't really seem to be too fast because he's an angsty teen that doesn't want to move.
Yeah, don't mind him. He has angst.
Right, but apparently it wasn't their fault, and it was implied that maybe it's Danny's?
Yeah, they seem to be setting up Danny as some sort of villain, sort of like the way that they set up Matthew Applewhite in a previous season.
Yes, yeah.
It's very similar vibes.
Similar vibes, but this seems to be a bit more on the nose.
Oh, yeah.
So we see Danny staring out the window at Julie. And yeah, that's where the scene ends.
Yeah.
But people always move to suburbia because this is where Angie says, oh, you know, we need to be suitable people and, you know, no secrets and blah, blah, blah. People always seem to think that they can come to suburbia and they'll be safe. But that's where people ask the questions because they're bored.
Yeah, that's where all the gossips are and the people that look out their curtain windows.
Exactly, because they're bored, they've got nothing else to do, so they pry.
I was going to save it for Susan's scenes, but nice to see Julie back.
Yeah, I know, we will get to that in season scene, but it is really nice to see Julie back.
But I don't like this possible villain staring across the road at her.
No.
What are your intentions with our Julie?
So we're now at 6 weeks before the wedding, and the ladies around Bree's house meeting Angie for coffee and food, and Danny is apparently almost ready to start college, but Susan then pipes up to say that she thought he already had started because he'd already asked Julie to tutor him in math, which surprises Angie.
Yeah, so he's already doing things that annoy her.
Yeah, and she has this sort of look, which is kind of concerning. Mm. Like, maybe what has he done with young... Not, I don't want to say young girls, because Danny is young as well, but what else has he done with girls before they moved here?
Well, he is quite a big guy, so you kind of get this idea, like, what does he do with teen girls who are smaller than him, who maybe can't defend themselves?
Throw them around a bit, slap them about.
It's very concerning.
It is concerning, yeah. So Catherine then turns up to drop something off to Bree, and Susan isn't too pleased about this, because apparently she hasn't spoken to Catherine since everything went down, so she hides. Not well. But she hides behind Lynette.
Yeah.
Is it Lynette or Gabby? One of them.
It's Lynette.
Catherine calls out Susan for hiding and ignoring her. And then Lynette notices that Catherine's buttons are done up all funny on her top. And I'm mentioning this because this links to a future storyline. Mm. So, just FYI. Julie is then tutoring Danny, but he isn't listening. And he invites Julie to a movie instead, but just as friends, apparently. And so Julie agrees. And this is when Nick enters. Gets rid of Danny out the room, so he's left alone with Julie, and that's when he thanks Julie for not shooting Danny down and apparently humouring him because he thinks Julie's way out of his son's league.
Yeah, what the hell?
Which is vile. This whole scene is gross, and it's like there seems to be a bit of flirting going on between Julie and Nick.
Yeah, it's not confirmed that this guy is his dad or stepdad or whatever he may be, but he's clearly his parental figure who's just walked into the room and spoke to some random girl and said, that guy's not in your league, so... What the fuck?
They're all Bolins, so from first glance, we can assume that they are all biologically related.
Yeah.
Because normally, if the mum gets married, the child's name doesn't change.
So when your father, parental figure, comes in and just is like, you're not in his league.
Yeah. It's like, thanks for humouring him, but you're way out of his league. Screw me instead.
Thanks, Dad.
We then cut to after the wedding for Angie, and she's freaking out to Nick about where Danny might be, as he hasn't come home because he's causing a scene, and she needs everyone to think that they're nice, normal people. And that's when she takes off her dress, and we see a huge scar down one side of her. Like acid or burn marks or something like that.
Yeah, girl's been through something.
Yeah, she's been through some shit.
If you want everyone to think that you're nice, normal people, just behave like nice, normal people.
Right. That was Angie, Danny, and Nick's introduction to the show, anyway.
Yeah, it's a very on-the-nose introduction.
It is a very on-the-nose introduction. They have lost their creativity with keeping us guessing a little bit, it feels like.
Angie is a character that I like, but for an introduction to a neighbour of the season, this is quite poor.
It is a poor one, but I do enjoy what Angie brings to season six. I think she brings some sort of... She brings a vibrance, she brings like a sassiness to the group, but a different kind of sassy than Gabby or Brie.
She's kind of filling in for Edie a little bit.
Oh yeah, she definitely brings that sort of strength that Edie brought. So I do appreciate Angie. So let's move on to Gabby. And Anna is leaving for school, but Gabby can see through her, like right through her, basically, unlike dumbass Carlos. And she tells Anna to lift up her ugly baggy jumper because girls that spend an hour on their hair and makeup do not go to school dressed like that. And I swear, I'm going to be getting all of my parenting tips from Gabby.
Well, it always sounds like I'm just coming for Carlos, doesn't it? But why is he being such an idiot?
A literal idiot.
He's like, oh yeah, this is normal. And instead of sticking up for Gabby, who has been a teenage girl herself and has been a pretty girl and knows all these tricks, he's just like, Gabby,
oh my god, Gabby, why are you being so horrible? You automatically assume the worst in Anna. Gabby,
Carlos disgusts me.
So Gabby demands that Anna lift up her ugly baggy jumper, and she reveals what I'm assuming for a straight teen boy is considered a smoking hot crop top.
Well, the fact that it's a crop top at all is the problem in their eyes, because this is the 2000s.
Yeah, so Gabby tells Anna to go and change, which she begrudgingly does, but not without some half-assed read, which then Juanita snaps.
Oh, yeah, Juanita is enjoying her presence.
Oh, Juanita's picking up some of Anna's attitude right now. Anna's there like, I'll wear one of your tops. It might be nice for it to go someplace besides the supermarket.
Well, I think that our little Juanita is just happy that someone is standing up to Gabby for once.
Probably. Juanita's probably really appreciating the fact that all the while that Anna is distracting Gabby, Juanita's safe.
Yeah.
So he believes Anna might calm down if they become her official legal guardians, but Gabby wants to see a change in Anna's behaviour before she commits. And that's when Anna walks back in and with a new top on, but Gabby stops her before she leaves and checks her bag and pulls out the old one.
Yeah, the girl's got tricks up her sleeves, and Carlos isn't prepared for teenagers.
No, and Anna might have tricks up her sleeve, but Gabby knows all these tricks.
She probably just thinks, these people don't have teenagers, they're not going to know what I'm going to get up to, but little does she know that Gabby was a teenage girl, and she was probably just like Anna.
Oh, absolutely. So Gabby is taking Karen to the shop, and it turns out Karen has a new man in her life, and he's called Roy.
Good for her.
Right? And she starts giving Gabby some of the more in-depth details of their love life, and Gabby shuts her up. And then they pull up at Gabby's, and Anna is there washing Carlos's car in a bid to win points with Gabby so that Gabby will let her go to this new party. And Gabby does agree at first until she finds out it starts at 11, past Anna's curfew, and so changes her mind. And then Anna storms off in a huff, leaving Gabby unsure on how to proceed, really.
There is a very big difference between a party and then going out clubbing after 11.
Yeah.
I don't know how she thought she was going to swing that by. I don't know why she didn't just sneak out right away, to be honest.
Yeah, I know. Why even ask? Because you're 16 and you're asking to go to a club.
Yeah, I know. But teenage girls, they're the best reason not to have kids. Words to live by, Karen.
So Carlos is working late and Gabby's going to say goodnight to the kids, and she notices Anna is sleeping until she hears some overdramatic snoring. And so she pulls back the covers and it's Juanita, and apparently Anna paid her $5. That's literally it.
Well,
$5.
Kids don't need much.
Kids, they just have no concept of money when they're that young. So they're like, wow, $5. I would literally make it 15. You got a deal.
It's a few Kit Kats though.
Yeah. So Gabby runs off to the club to try and find Anna, and she pays off the DJ so she can talk to everybody and try to get them to rat Anna out. And we have a clip.
Hi, my niece is somewhere in this building. She's got brown hair, gold leggings, a cream top, which she took from my closet. So if you could just look around and point her out. No, hey, this is important, okay? She's only 16 and she came here even though she knew she wasn't supposed to. Hey, Either you find my niece, or I will call the cops with their drug-sniffing dogs.
It's hilarious that she thought this would work, considering that none of those kids are probably allowed to be there.
No, I know. And I just, oh, it's just so weird to see Gabby in this situation all of a sudden, where she's being booed by a crowd of people.
I know, suddenly a younger woman walks into the situation, and Gabby's the old mum.
Yeah.
She's an old mum figure now.
But she gets them all eventually. That threat turns everybody against Anna, and they point her out and crowd surf her to the front. And Gabby basically grabs her and is like, I told you not to mess with me, which was fierce.
It was quite fierce. She's like, I may be an old bitch now, but I got some tricks up my sleeve.
She's literally like, you can't beat me. Don't even try it, okay? You cannot beat me. So they pull up at home, and Anna tells Gabby that kicking her out would actually be doing her a favor, as she can take care of herself. And then she admits that she wants to be a model. She claims it was easy for Gabby because, you know, Gabby left home young and still did it. But Gabby reminds her that she didn't really have a choice. And then Anna tries to turn it into a competition of whose sad childhood was worse. Anna doesn't believe that she's wanted. And then she quotes Gabby from earlier in the episode when Gabby said that she's keeping all of her options open, basically. And so Gabby gets out of the car, goes into the house. Anna follows, and Gabby sits her down and signs the adoption papers, telling Anna that she's now her legal guardian and she'll be watching her like a hawk so that she can stop her from ruining her life before she even starts living it.
Yeah, it was a really nice scene. And I mean, they've written Anna in a very good way. In comparison to the Bolands, at least, where Anna kind of does have the mindset of a teenage girl, the way that she's like, I'll just be a model. You did it. Look how easy it was. And it's like,
yeah,
you don't know anything about this.
She's also a hurt teenage girl as well. So they've written her really well in that respect, in that she does want a home. She does want a family. And you can see it at the end of the scene. You see it in her reacting to be finally signing those papers. But she doesn't want to admit that she actually wants that. She's strong. She's survived everything she survived. She doesn't need anybody. She does want them, though.
So they wrote her quite well. And parenting brownie points for Gabby.
Yeah, I have to say, I know it's your award, but Gabby gets parent of the show. For me, like the whole show, not just this episode. Like this scene always gets me emotional because I think it's just such a perfect showing of Gabby's growth from season one as someone who had no interest in kids. And look at her now.
Yes.
And then that's where that Gabby's story ends. So let's do Brie. So 8 weeks before the wedding, Mary Alice is talking about sin, and she uses Brie as almost like a perfect example of suburban people living with sins. And then we cut to Brie and Carl making out. But Brie is repenting because she feels awful, and Carl convinces her that she's being stupid, and they continue. And then they go to have sex, but Brie doesn't want to do it on his office couch because he's probably fucked many a client on that couch, and she wants it to be a special affair. This is a special affair, guys.
Yeah, I did like that line. But what Brie and Carl are doing is kind of awful, but Carl makes it sound very sensible, and he's like, but you'll be getting back at Carlos. And suddenly Bree's like, sorry, Orson.
She could get back at Carlos if she wants.
But I want to get back at Carlos. He pisses me off. No, when Carl says, you'll be getting back at Orson, and then Bree's like, oh, you know what? This is a good idea.
Yeah, he's just like, but just think about it. Each time I'm banging you is like a little bit more of a dent in Orson's armor. And she's like, oh, just do me right here.
Right.
So Carl finds a sleazy motel for them to fuck in, basically. And apparently he took her to a nice one previously, but she saw someone she knew. And now she's having second thoughts again, because the thought of having sex in a dirty room is vile to her.
Well, he is hot, but why did he bring her to Bates Motel?
I'd do him anywhere,
not
honestly.
In Bates Motel. This is horrible. I don't blame her.
Yeah, I would. The dirtier, the better. So Brie instead manages to convince him to go shopping for bedding and then flowers. And the flowers prove to be the last straw for Carl, who quickly realises that Brie is just stalling and she doesn't actually want the affair because she's a good girl who never breaks the rules, even if it makes her miserable.
I just want this affair to be nice. She says, picking up all of the Egyptian cotton bedding and stuff.
Ooh, Egyptian cotton.
This is a really strange scene.
This is the weirdest storyline I've seen for quite a while.
But it does make sense. It's Brie trying to venture out and do something bad and look out for her own happiness and needs, but she just can't do it. And she acts so strange and Brie-ish about it.
Carl got it right. She is stalling, because all the while that she doesn't do it, she's not actually committing to the act, but she also doesn't want to flat out say no, just in case in the future she does want to do it and she's lost her opportunity to do it with Carl.
Yeah.
So the day before the wedding, Brie is at the church setting up, and Orson walks in telling Brie he wants counselling, but she doesn't care. She only wants a divorce. And so he tells Brie that withholding sex won't work, because he can be patient, reminding her that he got no sex in prison.
Which apparently was a question she had, and she's very glad that that was covered up.
Oh, thank you for asking, answering a question I never quite knew how to ask.
When he said, "You might think that withholding sex will make me give up on us," I thought, I don't really think that's entirely what Bree's doing here.
No.
I think she's clearly out. She's out.
Yeah, she's not withholding sex. She just doesn't want to have sex with someone she doesn't have feelings for anymore.
Yeah, she just doesn't want to have sex with you. She's not withholding it for any particular reason.
So Orson believes, still, that he can make Bree happy, and she reminds him that his blackmail means she isn't his wife anymore, but his captive.
Yeah, missing the forest for the trees a bit.
Yeah, just a bit. So it's the day of the wedding, and Bree tells Carl that she will meet him tonight for a good dicking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's essentially where Bree's story ends. Carl asks her why she's changed her mind, and she's like, oh, well, I realise that guilt is a small price to pay for happiness.
Yeah.
So Lynette is sat at the table having an existential crisis about being pregnant and old, and we have a clip.
Look, I know this wasn't planned, but we can do this. I mean, we had a lot of fun raising the first four kids.
But we were done, Tom. We were across the finish line. No more diapers, no more strained carrots, no more reading stupid Goodnight Moon.
Lynette.
And with Preston going to Europe, we even had one moving out. We will never be done if we birth two every time one moves out. That's just math.
So as a quick reminder, the one that has moved out is one of the twins. He's gone backpacking around Europe.
Yeah, so that's officially being allowed to happen. That was
briefly discussed at the end of the season, but never actually confirmed.
I mean, bless Tom. He's trying to make the most of it, but he's clearly trying to move past the old parents' dread stage and into the this could be okay stage.
Yeah, and Lynette makes a valid point. Like, I wouldn't want to be that old at my kids' graduation, but at the same time, they won't be the only old people there. There'll be grandparents there as well.
Yeah, but that's not a comfort to look at them and they're like, where's your grandson or granddaughter?
Yeah, they need Joe Frost. That's who they need right now.
Super Nanny.
Yeah. Lynette's in a crisis.
Lynette's always in a crisis.
I'm on my way.
They might as well just have her as like a live-in.
They should. I would watch that show.
The live-in nanny.
Yeah. Like, Lynette is at the doctor's for a checkup, which I guess that's where she is. And there is a happy couple there waiting for their appointment as well. So Lynette obviously decides to ruin this nice woman's day by freaking her out.
Yeah, she looks disgusted by the naivety of this young couple.
Well, the husband or partner or what have you, dad-to-be, goes off to get a drink or whatever and leaves Lynette alone with the mum. And that's when it comes out that it's their first. So they're going to have that sort of naive young parent attitude towards children, where Lynette, who's a bit more weathered, let's say, and it has all of the experience and knowledge to basically terrify this poor young woman.
Yeah, it's a little bit cruel, isn't it?
Just a bit cruel.
She's like, no, everything you've heard is a lie. Right? Being a mum's hard.
Most women say this is the most magical experience of their life. Most women are liars.
My mum was a liar. Your mum was a liar.
This scene sticks with me. I've never forgotten this scene. This has always been one of the scenes I've always remembered from Desperate Housewives. And I think it's because she paints such a vivid picture of what pregnancy and motherhood is like.
But all that she's focused on is the destruction of her body.
Yeah, she's like, her body's horrible. Her husband gets her birthday presents from the car wash. She's never alone anymore, even though she feels alone.
Yeah. That line.
That line really hits.
You'll feel lonely, but you're never actually alone.
There'll be so many times when you feel lonely, but you'll never be alone.
Please stop talking to me. It very much sounds like season one Lynette, when she was so stressed and she just wanted to kill herself.
Yeah.
It's very much given me that energy. What a throwback.
So Lynette and Tom are at the sonogram visit and the doctor leaves to get the nurse. But Tom knows something is up with Lynette, as it's been 3 months and where's the excitement? And she finally admits to Tom that she doesn't love the babies. And in the past, you know, she's never expected any of the kids, but she's always loved them. But this time she doesn't feel any love, which is really sad, actually. And quite a heartbreaking story for Lynette in this episode.
Oh, yeah, this is a very hard-hitting scene. And it must be an absolute minefield of emotions for Lynette here to be not excited when hearing the heartbeat of your babies in the womb and think, I don't love them, which is a very valid emotion because all emotions are valid, but yeah. It must also make you feel so guilty.
I find it interesting to know how many people resonate with this episode story for Lynette, because you'll probably be surprised. Like, Lynette says in this episode that if she can't talk about it with Tom, then she's screwed. Basically, Tom's the only person she should really be able to talk to about this. Probably feeling quite alone in the way that she's feeling, but you'd probably be surprised that there's many women out there that probably can resonate with this storyline and have felt those feelings that Lynette has felt at some point or another during their pregnancy.
Oh yeah, but we live in a society and women aren't allowed to feel that because women have to be maternal.
Yeah, you have to be maternal. You're baby-making machines. That's the only reason you're here, guys.
So, a lot of pressure. And yeah. Felicity Huffman acts out of the park, as always.
As always, she always tackles these types of scenes with just, perfection.
But yeah, two big emotional scenes in one episode. They were really starting off the season strong there.
Right. So Tom ends the scene by shutting her up and telling her that she will eventually start to feel the love and she just needs to stop freaking out. She's freaking out at the moment, basically.
Yeah, he's very rational. He's like, calm down, we'll get there. It's going to be fine.
Yeah.
Being her rock.
So finally, we have Susan. And so it doesn't take long to find out that the bride is Susan, really. We're straight into the scene, pretty much. And she's marrying Mike again. So what I don't get is why she makes such a big deal out of it. Like, surely something smaller, a smaller ceremony would have been a little bit more humble.
Yeah, I don't get how they can afford some of this stuff. Like, the finest shoes from Milan, for example. I thought they weren't that well off. Wasn't that a whole storyline in the last season?
Yeah, with Susan having to get a job.
Like, she had to get a job because her books couldn't support her and the child anymore with just Mike's plumbing job. And now suddenly they can afford the finest shoes from Milan for a second wedding?
Considering that Mike has also just spent money on plane tickets to Vegas, which he didn't even use.
Oh, yeah. And let's not forget that in our lifetime, we're not going to be able to afford more than one wedding in our lifetime.
No, I know, right?
But yeah, it should have been a smaller wedding. This doesn't make sense.
No, but anyway, anything that brings back our Lord and Savior Julie, I'm fine with. The fact that this wedding is going ahead, as long as it's brought back Julie, it's a good thing in my eyes.
Also, in the last episode, Lynette ran off to throw up during the wedding at the end of the last episode, but here she is clapping along when Susan and Mike kiss.
Oh, good spot.
Funny that.
So Susan feels awful, believing that Catherine will never forgive her, but Julie tells her not to worry, and then the bride and groom kiss. And when they're at the altar, we cut to that point, and as they walk down the aisle, Catherine is stood there for dramatic.
Oh yeah, and she looks really dishevelled, and it makes you think, what the hell happened leading up to this?
Yeah, yeah.
And oh boy, it's a doozy.
It is a doozy. So we cut back to 8 weeks previously, and Mike is meeting Catherine to apologise and tell her about him and Susan, and she claims she isn't really surprised because she could never see them growing old together, and she returns the ring.
Yeah, so it's a nice start. From this start, I was thinking, does Susan and Mike do something to make her turn and go a bit crazy?
No.
Because here she seems perfectly fine. So I was like, okay, so Susan's obviously going to do something to make her turn.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking when I saw this.
But also at the same time, I don't feel bad for Catherine at all.
No, she did. She manipulated her way back.
Yeah, this is what happens when you manipulate commitments out of people. You're sat there like, you know, I never could see us old together. No, but it didn't stop you from manipulating commitments out of him.
Yeah, but I also do feel a little bit bad for her because Mike was being emotionally withheld and cold.
Yeah, he was. But if you have to manipulate a commitment out of someone, then that someone isn't for you. If that person is emotionally cold towards you, then there's something wrong there.
So really, we shouldn't feel bad for any of these people.
No, absolutely not.
This whole Catherine, Mike, Susan situation is a mess that they've gotten themselves into, and they all deserve each other.
Yeah. So Mike returns home, and Susan is there waiting to hear how it all went, clearly panicking that Catherine isn't happy with her. But Mike thinks it will be easier for Susan to talk to her now. I don't think Susan seems too thrilled at that idea and now is trying to avoid her.
Yeah, in classic clumsy Susan kind of fashion.
Yeah.
I just wonder if they've spoken to MJ about this yet. It never comes up in the episode.
No, it doesn't. And I imagine it's quite confusing for him.
Yeah. I mean, it must be hard enough to have Susan as your mum.
Yeah. Okay, so we move on to the next scene. It's a scene, all right, this scene. So Susan isn't home and the delivery man leaves her bridal gown with Catherine instead. So when Susan gets home, she obviously freaks out and then is quite rightly disgusted when Catherine opens the door and she sees what she sees, which is Catherine wearing her wedding dress whilst cooking some giant vat of tomato sauce or something.
It's quite a shocking thing to withhold, isn't it?
It really is. It gave Friends energy, you know, when they're all wearing the wedding dresses and Rachel opens the door and is like, I do.
Except you watch it and you're not struck with humor. It's more fear. Like,
and
oh my god, that's such an expensive dress. What is she doing?
And concern. Like, I am. This is quite a concerning thing for Catherine to do. This isn't a.
It's not a normal thing to do.
Yeah, it's not like a sane thing to do.
Yeah, she's got to come over and then battle Mrs. Havisham to get her dress back.
So it feels a little concerning that Catherine's doing something like this.
But I love the sauce scene.
Oh, it is hilarious. Like, this scene is crazy. This is utter, in true Desperate Housewives fashion, it's Desperate Housewives crazy is what I'm going to say. Mm. So Susan and Catherine are sort of there. Susan's freaking out about the sauce bubbling up and possibly going all over the dress. And Catherine's there kind of like using it against her, knowing full well it's making Susan uncomfortable.
Stirring this big bubbling pot of sauce in the wedding dress, leaning over, smelling it. Mm.
She's like, oh, this fabric feels really expensive. It is.
Mm, Susan, when's your Dolmio day?
Mamma mia.
Turn down the heat. It is bubbling too much.
It is bubbling too much. And Catherine's there like, oh, the secret is to never stop stirring. And I was like, but you stopped stirring when you answered the door.
True. But she means the pot. Not the physical pot. The metaphorical pot.
True. Oh, gag. So Susan is finally done. It gets to a point where she just kind of slams the lid on the pot. And she's like, I'm done. I want my dress back. And then I think Catherine seems to realise that maybe she's gone a bit too far.
Yeah, that face drop, like, what the fuck am I doing?
Yeah, she kind of had this realisation there where she was acting a bit, I don't want to use the word crazy, she was acting a bit mental.
Oh, that's much better. No, yeah, I get what you mean. She's like, my behaviour is, this isn't the one.
No, not this. So Mike comes home and Susan and Julie are trying to clean the dots of red off her dress whilst filling Mike in on everything that's happened. So he thinks he should go talk to Catherine again, but Susan's had enough of everyone tiptoeing around her, reminding him and the audience that she was with Mike first and that Catherine was the other woman and not her. And she's now getting fed up of every time she tells people that she's getting married to Mike, there is no congratulations. It's all, oh, how's Catherine?
Well, in all fairness, it looks pretty bad on Mike and Susan.
Yeah.
From an outsider perspective, you don't know that Catherine has manipulated her way into that situation. All you see is that Catherine got with this guy while Susan was single and with someone else at the time as well.
Mm.
And then all of a sudden, they just get back together.
I wonder if Mike knows any more about that manipulation stuff now. Like, mate, your girlfriend is mental.
I just don't like that they decided to get married again so soon. I think it was really icky.
Yeah.
Like, you don't do that, especially when your friend was with him, who lives right there.
Yeah.
Like, this is really bad behaviour. So
it is.
They all deserve each other. But it's nice to have Julie back and throwing shade at Susan when she was like, white was a stretch anyway, Mum.
Yeah, but what I didn't like was what Julie ended the scene with. Susan storms off and then Julie turns to Mike and she says, of the two that you could have married, that's the sane one.
Is it?
And I'm like, is it?
Is she? Catherine, I'm not sure.
Catherine was pretty sane until she got with Mike. Mike is Catherine's downfall.
Susan and Mike have made Catherine this way.
Yeah, I mean, I blame Mark Cherry, not Mike, but...
Actually, no, that being said, Catherine was always a little bit dodgy.
No, she wasn't.
Don't you remember the whole baby girl under the bookcase story and...
Oh, yeah, but that wasn't Catherine, that was the story.
Yeah, but it didn't make her look very good, did it?
No, it didn't, but considering that Catherine and Susan are the oldest friends on the lane... Like, Susan knew Catherine when Catherine originally lived on Wisteria Lane. Nobody else did.
Mm.
So for you to treat your oldest friend on the lane this way...
I know, it's trash. They're all trash.
So Susan is mentally preparing herself for going down the aisle, and Catherine enters the room telling Susan the dress looked better on her.
Catherine is full of these zingy little one-liners today, isn't she?
So she tells Susan that she's been royally pissed at the fact that Susan never came over and apologised or went to check up on her, which I don't blame. And Catherine demands a public apology in the middle of Susan's wedding, which Susan refuses. Catherine threatens to create an ugly scene if she doesn't, so Susan reluctantly agrees and then shoves Catherine into a closet and locks her in.
Yeah, oh my gosh, I don't even...
I'd do the same.
The implications behind just shoving this woman in the closet, it's so strange. Anyway.
It's also...
foreshadowing?
Yeah, I was about to say, it's foreshadowing when I think about it.
Yeah, Catherine has a point. Susan should have gone over to talk to her.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a... Not, you know, just talk to her about it. Maybe not marry Mike straight away as well. The horrible cow. But the public apology thing is a really unreasonable request.
Yeah, it's a wedding. No, I'm not publicly apologising. So I would have done the same. I'd have shoved her in a closet until after the wedding to stop that ugly scene.
Yeah.
Because Catherine has shown quite a couple of times in this episode that she is more than capable of creating that ugly scene if she wants to. So yeah, let's just protect ourselves from that.
Oh yeah. But if you think that a small door... would stop her.
Yeah, well, it doesn't, because during the ceremony, Catherine breaks down the door and is there in the aisle ready for them. So Mike asks Catherine to leave, but if she doesn't, he'll go all Daddy Mike and throw her out of the church himself. And then Catherine apologizes, and then Susan finally steps up and apologizes to her in front of everyone, and she hugs Catherine and asks her if it made her feel any better, but apparently it didn't.
I mean, we were scared for Dark Bree, but Dark Catherine's entered the building. Honestly, the redheads are just coming out.
It's absolutely hilarious that Susan ruins her wedding to give this public apology, hugs Catherine to be like, I hope that made you feel better. And then Catherine's like, no.
No. Also, this is the second time in this episode that Catherine has done something crazy and then realized how she's been acting and not apologized.
Yes.
How many times is it? You can't just keep doing that, Catherine.
But I think the only reason she apologized in this instance was because Mike was the one basically saying, girl, you need to sort your shit out.
Well, she did it earlier with the sauce.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, she keeps realizing that she's acting a bit mental and then apologizing. And it's like, maybe just stop it then.
Yeah. So Mary Alice ends the episode talking about sin again. And we see Bree cheating on Carl, Lynette pulling out old maternity clothes, Catherine looking out of a window. And finally, Julie is taking out the trash when someone comes up behind her and strangles her before running off, leaving Julie's body on the ground in front of the house. But who has strangled Julie?
Yeah, what a weird ending. Didn't see that coming.
No, I know.
They obviously want you to think it's Danny Bolan.
They obviously want you to think it's Danny. But then for some true crime enthusiasts, they'll probably immediately believe that Danny's the obvious choice and go with Nick.
I feel like the wedding was a very strange thing to end the last season with and start this season with. It's very dramatic and very in keeping with a sort of let's begin with a big thing. But I don't think that it should have happened.
It's just, how many weddings can we begin and end with?
Yeah, it's like they wanted to keep up a tradition of weddings or something.
Yeah.
But I think they should have left the wedding for later on in the season and have a build-up of Catherine getting more and more unhinged.
Yeah, that would have been cool.
Because I think that was lazy.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I get what you mean.
So, let's move on to our next segment where Joel's going to give us the gayest and the straightest moment of the episode, starting with the gayest moment.
So, my award for gayest moment goes to Gabby for stopping an entire club just to find her underage niece. That's gay parenting right there. I aspire to be that kind of parent.
Yeah, it's pretty fierce. It's like, no, if you mess with me, I'll get you no matter what.
Yeah. I feel like only gays would go to that level.
I don't mind looking crazy to get what I want.
Yeah, exactly. I think we would go to that level to teach our child a lesson and humiliate them. We will humiliate ourselves if we have to get that lesson taught to you.
Yeah, I'm fine being humiliated.
Yeah.
I do it every day.
Yeah.
And then what do you have for straightest moment?
My award for straightest moment goes to Nick for flirting with his son's crush. It's creepy, and the lines that he used were incredibly hetero.
You know, I think the worst thing is, I don't think he was flirting, but it's just the way that straight dads sometimes talk to girls. It just feels flirty and icky.
No, he was definitely flirting.
It gives me the same vibes as when Carlos was like, I don't remember that.
Yeah. But yeah, so those are my awards. And now we move on to B's awards for best and worst parents. So, baby, do you have for the best parent?
So, my award for
best parent of the episode.
I gave this to Gabby for officially taking in Anna, eventually, which was a very nice character moment, very strong character growth. And I can see some very good storylines coming from this.
Yes. Yeah, I would agree with that. People already know I agree with that. I gave her my best parent of the show award. Cool. So congratulations, Gabby. And now who do you have for the worst parent of the episode?
So my award for
worst parent of the episode,
I gave this to Carlos for letting Anna disrespect Gabby.
Fair. Actually, yeah, I would say that's fair enough.
I'm just sick of it. But no, I'm giving it to Carlos because he's constantly disrespecting Gabby in front of people, including his kids, even though Gabby has already shown that she knows what Anna's up to and what she's doing. And yet he still doesn't get it.
Yeah.
I'm like, but she just showed you that she gets the tricks that Anna is doing. Why don't you just have her back? Pisses me off.
No, I agree. I agree with that.
Parents that don't have the other parents back, they're not in their corner. It's not the one.
No, it's not. Not at all.
So that...
shoddy parenting, that.
So bravo, bravo, fucking bravo. And that brings us to the end of the episode. So if anyone has any questions, queries, comments and theories, where can they find us?
You can find us on Instagram at boyfriendsreview, and you can find us on Twitter at BFSreview.
We also have email, which is boyfriendsreview@outlook.com, And you can find Louis, who does the artwork, at Doc Red Monk Design, and there's also a link to his Etsy page. And if you do feel so inclined, please do leave us a review, and we will read it out if we ever get one.
Yeah.
So join us next week when we'll be back in your ear holes with Season 6, Episode 2, Being Alive.
Yes.
See you then.
See you then, guys. Bye. Goodbye.